Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, I'll talk with Leah Libresco Sargent about Harvey Weinstein, the film mogul whose long career of sexual harassment and assault has occasioned some soul-searching in Hollywood. Weinstein's misconduct was an open secret there for years. Is his exposure an indictment of the film industry or of all of us? Then, I'll talk with First Things editor Rusty Reno and senior editor Matthew Schmitz about dogs. We'll establish that emotional support animals are not a thing. Then we'll debate whether dogs are man's best friend or stalking horses for the culture of death. Finally, I'll follow up on some of these issues with special guest Lucy Reno. I'm senior editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. Harvey Weinstein, founder of Miramax and the Weinstein Company, two boutique film studios that for a while had a monopoly on Oscar bait, has been accused of numerous acts of sexual harassment and assault, from indecent proposals all the way up to rape, against actresses both aspiring and established. For decades, payoffs and fears of legal and professional reprisal kept most of his victims from alerting the police. But on the heels of solid reporting by The New Yorker and The New York Times, bolstered by audio recorded during a sting operation, the Weinstein Company looks like it will shut down, and Harvey is in rehab for sex addiction, which probably won't save him from either criminal prosecution or the nervous breakdown he appears to be undergoing. I'm joined by Leah Libresco Sargent, who's written a fine essay on Weinstein for firstthings.com. Leah discusses how the relaxation of norms governing sex and the way we talk about sex makes it harder for us to tell the genuine creeps from the ordinary vulgarians, and so gives the creeps an environment in which to flourish. Leah, welcome, and tell us about that.
Well, I think Harvey Weinstein is definitely marked out as a deliberate, serial, vicious predator who spent a lot of time using all the power he'd amassed to doubly brutalize women, first in sexually harassing and assaulting them, and second in silencing them, when even when they went to the police, he was able to bring pressure to bear both with the, you know, attorneys, it looks like, and in the press to slander one of his victims. But what I think, you know, is not as unique to Weinstein is that in the workplace and in other places, the more we tolerate crudity, vulgarity, and discussion of sex and sexuality that's intended to get a rise out of people, the harder it is for bystanders and anyone else to stand up to or notice a Weinstein, especially because their abuses tend to take place in private, because it looks like being boisterous. You know, the more that people casually discuss their sex lives in the workplace, it's not as clear which person is doing that to find a victim and which person is victimizing people almost by accident.
And you have a really interesting example in your essay of a workplace in which a lot of very vulgar language and behavior was common. And it seemed to be a matter not just of norms that have been sort of relaxed, things that are now in bounds, but there was also a kind of ideological justification for it.
Yeah, the period underwear company, Thinks, which is a kind of underwear for women to wear on their period without using a tampon or a pad.
Right, it's like Sexy Depends.
Sort of.
I remember seeing their ads in the Union Square subway station last spring.
And here's where it starts being interesting. Their ads were rejected, or close to rejected, by the subway because they were kind of suggestive. And that's been the shtick of the company from the beginning. It's led by a female CEO who kind of defends...
A CEO.
Oh, dear. So who kind of defends this sex shtick by saying, you know, women's sexuality is silenced, which is true to an extent. So we need to be loud, proud, brash, and vulgar to kind of reclaim our space. And she brought that same spirit to her office, where she commented on the breasts of her female employees, changed in front of employees, like fully changed.
She would Skype into meetings,
oh,
right?
From when the
she
toilet.
Was, exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, groped employees. And there were a number of complaints. And it sounds like it was a horrible place to work. And whether or not she really believed in the ideology of it's progressive and helpful to sexualize my employees as an ideological stance, or whether she was using that as cover for her own predatory behavior as a way to shut down employees who criticized her, is honestly unclear to me, because I think someone can, in good faith, hold the view it's good to shock prudes, it's good for them. You know, the higher their eyebrows go, the better the service you've done them.
Yeah, so it seems like the Think's office space here in New York was a much worse place to work than, say, the Sterling Cooper offices in the imagined early 60s world of Mad Men. And that's one of the things I was kind of thinking about when I listened to this audio recording of Weinstein, picked up during this police sting. And on this recording, the young woman is wearing a wire, and she confronts him about his having groped her without her consent. And he says to her, he apologizes basically, and then he says, well, listen, I'm used to that, and says that this is kind of what he was, this is how he was taught to treat women when he was coming up, when he was young. And I figure that's probably true, because I thought immediately of the notorious casting couch, and there's a casting couch at Sterling Cooper on Mad Men, and these young actresses are expected to be available to these ad execs who are auditioning them. And with Mad Men, there's always this overtone of, well, now we know better. But did we really imagine that in an era of even greater physical and verbal license, that sexual exploitation of this sort would become less common?
I think it's not surprising at all. And the reason, you know, it shouldn't be surprising is because exploitation, period, is still common among actors particularly and in many other contexts. How much of a warning do you need that people might sexually exploit actors when they already financially exploit them? Where you have almost the same grooming or coaching behavior where you're telling people, of course, like, you'll understand the business better. It doesn't make sense that you'd be paid for your work. You know, it's an honor just to work for us for no money. Of course, you know, you're going to be groped. That's how our business works. You have to get used to it. I think Liz Brunick has written well about how, you know, we have a number of places where by default, journalism is a place like this too, where employers exploit their workers, don't pay them, have them work hours that are not legal. And it isn't that surprising that people who already take advantage of workers in a difficult position would sometimes, if they're sexually attracted to them, or if they feel like if they're a sexual predator as well as an economic predator, take advantage of them in one additional way.
Right. With the Think's example, you know, you saw also that kind of economic structure of exploitation where these young women working for the company were paid very low salaries, mm-hmm. right? And then they were told, well, hold out to the end of the year because we give big bonuses. Yeah. So basically, toe the line, follow the rules, don't complain, and then you'll get what's coming to you.
Well, and again, an ideological veneer for that also. You're doing such good work for women, it would be venal to want to be paid for mm-hmm. it.
So Leah, give us one more kind of flagrant artifact of the culture of vulgarity.
Well, one thing that bothers me a lot living here in New York City is that there are these women called desnudas, which as the name may imply are almost entirely naked. They're topless, they're wearing tiny underwear and some amount of body paint in Times Square. And I think what's often underestimated is the extent to which, you know, sexuality misused is purely disruptive. It would be a nuisance claim, at least, to stand in Times Square setting off an air horn repeatedly. But to have these women there is a similar experience because it's loud and garish and unpleasant, garish even in Times Square. And it kind of takes sexuality and just makes it, you know, a blaring distraction rather than anything beautiful or particular to one person. And I think it's a shame. And I think a lot of vulgarity operates like that. It operates like, you know, just yelling, just noisemaking, and lowers your ability to focus on anything else.
Leah, in your essay, you also discuss the problem of rape-adjacent sex. So could you explain that category?
Mm-hmm. So When people talk about rape, there are kind of a variety of things that fall into that category. There's stranger in the bushes rape that's violent and sudden, and that's really very few of the cases of rape that people actually experience. And a lot more of them are ones where one partner's consent is not present, either because, you know, a no is ignored or because someone is too drunk to consent and so on. But what I was interested in talking about is people who certainly don't think of themselves as rapists and who may even be lucky in that their partner hasn't really consented but is okay with this and doesn't experience the sex as rape, so everyone goes home the next day feeling okay, but are giving cover to rapists by engaging in behavior that looks too much like predatory behavior so that the real predators can't be spotted. You know, and here I would say one example of rape-adjacent sex is just, you know, a guy who leaves a college party with a girl who he knows is intoxicated, and he doesn't know how intoxicated she is. He might be lucky. She might be a little bit buzzed, mostly just excitable, totally capable of giving consent, giving him real consent. Legally and morally, no rape has occurred, but he has no justified reason to believe that. So what he's doing is he's engaging in sex that's kind of in this gray area where he can't be confident his partner isn't experiencing it as rape. You know, and I think the important thing is to take a step back, not just from moments where, you know, the initiator of sex can tell they're raping someone, but from moments where you don't really have a confident belief you're not. And part of that's because, you know, the more you take a step back from that, first of all, the fewer rapes occur. It's not all rapes are a predator like Weinstein, but the more obvious it is when someone is deliberately preying on a woman. If it's normal at a party for a number of people to leave with intoxicated partners they've just met, many of those folks may all feel fine the next morning, but some of them won't. And the more people think it's odd to kind of have someone's arm over your shoulder as you're taking them out, the easier it is for a bystander to speak up.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that rape-adjacent sex, as you've explained it, covers a lot of the sex that is had these days. Mm-hmm. And I always think that when a scandal like the Weinstein scandal emerges, probably part of the intensity of our reaction against him and his crimes has something to do with our desire to draw a firm line between what is inbounds sexually and what is out of bounds, because we don't otherwise really have the equipment for that, you know, hence this sort of gray area that you've just described. And so I think that when the distinction between licit and illicit sex depends entirely on the issue of consent, which for many people today it does, that puts a lot of pressure on a category that is really pretty elusive. What counts as consent? Who's capable of giving consent? Under what circumstances? How can you tell? It's often it's difficult to tell, even for someone who's not a predator. By contrast, if consent is not everything and we live in a different kind of ethical system, if, say, sacramental marriage is required in order to make sex licit, then these problems go away in most instances. But that's, of course, a much more demanding ethical standard.
I think there's a middle ground that gets us a lot closer to decent behavior without perhaps taking people all the way to the theology of the body. Mm-hmm. And it's stepping away a little from this question of just, is it rape or not? Am I legally culpable for it or not, or culpable to my college or not? And it really just goes back to, are you willing the good of your partner? And I think that really points to, with both rape-adjacent sex and just willing the good, you have to know this person. I think, yeah, it's just incredibly difficult for anyone, no matter how well-intentioned, to have willing the good of their partner sex with a stranger, because you're barely having sex with that particular person. You're having sex with a woman, a man.
Right.
And, you know, that's where you get into also kind of other kinds of rape-adjacent sex of just, you know, well, if she says, oh, okay, and you barely know her, was that someone who doesn't feel like they have room to say no, whose kind of consent you're trampling on, or someone who's tired but up for it? Who knows? Who knows that with a stranger?
Right. Leah, something I like about your essay is that, you know, it's an essay that places us, all of us, somewhere on a continuum, which is far more valuable to me than just sort of one more denunciation of a man who's already been ejected from the moral community. So speaking of ejections of Harvey Weinstein from the moral community, any thoughts on the very odd statement that he released and which most of us came to through the New York Times website?
I think it points to the fact that he's been the kind of person for such a long time who doesn't let anyone say no to him professionally or personally, because there's no way his lawyer or his publicist thought that was a sane thing to release.
Right. Yeah, so he does say, quote, "I sincerely apologize," etc. So points for that.
Not that many points, to be honest.
Yeah,
when you apologize, you should say what you're apologizing for.
Yeah.
And he really doesn't do that. Yeah. He doesn't address the scope of what he did.
Right. And then he also says, quote, "My journey now will be to learn about myself and conquer my demons. I've brought on therapists, and I plan to take a leave of absence from my company and to deal with this issue head on." And so I'm dismayed, though not at all surprised, by the recourse there to therapeutic language. And now, of course, he's in rehab for sex addiction in a bid to convince us that his demons are really his sickness. Expert commentators observe that sex addiction has a very low recovery rate. I would suggest that maybe because it's very difficult to treat a fake disorder, there's no cure for sin except repentance, which we can hope he has.
Well, I think there's an extent to which with any besetting sin, there's an element of it that feels like addiction.
Right.
That, you know.
But this is a metaphor.
Yes.
To me, this should be understood as a metaphor.
You know, you see someone like Anthony Weiner, who, while not being explicitly predatory, is just so dumb in the pursuit of sex and so shattering everything else in his life to do it. You know, you feel like he must be enslaved to it somehow because no reasonable person would behave the way he does. Now, Weinstein looks more like he deliberately built a whole edifice to allow him to keep preying on people without having to incur any consequences himself.
Yeah.
But sex addiction or no, what I think he has to do is what he really has not done, which is apologize and say what I did was wrong. Like, and what I did, you know, however he felt, like, is an impulse I should have resisted, should have asked for help with earlier. And even if he was plausibly compelled in the moment to do this, every other step he took is more deliberate, rational steps to silence victims, to cover up his crimes. It's hard to put that all under the umbrella of bad impulse control.
No, indeed. So need we understand a contradiction between the prolonged and premeditated nature of his predation, his sins, on the one hand, and on the other hand, a notion that he was in some way enslaved to his impulses or to his vices?
Not really. I mean, I think one thing that's really noticeable at the other end of the spectrum of sin is that the saints in their own writings are just profoundly tormented by the smallest failing of their love of God. And it's because sin is always sin at every scale, and kind of the more perfect among us are the more bothered by small sins because they want to give themselves perfectly to God. But in every case, you know, whatever our capacity, God is always calling us to choose him and to turn away from sin. And it just varies for a lot of us at what scale those decisions are coming. You know, and for Weinstein, whether it's small decisions he made much earlier in his career that kind of helped cement this tendency in him, perhaps to the point where it was harder for him to turn away from temptation after making a habit of it, or even now, where he might have the chance, you know, even just with one individual woman he was preying on to say no, and that might be a great victory in heaven, even if he fell back the next day. You know, that every moment, moment by moment, we're choosing God or we're choosing sin. And that's the same in every person's life. And it's very hard from the outside to kind of tell at what scale someone is fighting that battle today.
Did you see Mayim Bialik's op-ed in the NYT? So on October 13th, Mayim Bialik, who's formerly the star of the 90s sitcom Blossom, which of course we all love, now she's on The Big Bang Theory. She rather poignantly described in this op-ed what it's like to be a comparatively plain actress in Hollywood. On the one hand, Harvey Weinstein leaves you alone. On the other hand, your career opportunities are very limited, and people will say nasty things about your looks in public. So apropos of sexual harassment, Bialik explained that she tends to dress and act very modestly, and this is in part because she's a pretty observant Jew. But also, she says, modesty solves a lot of problems. She writes, I still make choices every day as a 41-year-old actress that I think of as self-protecting and wise. I have decided that my sexual self is best reserved for private situations with those I'm most intimate with. I dress modestly. I don't act flirtatiously with men as a policy. Nothing, absolutely nothing, excuses men for assaulting or abusing women, but we can't be naive about the culture we live in. She got a lot of blowback for this. She was accused of blaming Weinstein's victims, and she issued an apology. I tend to read this op-ed more generously, but I don't know. What are your thoughts on it?
I think it's always tricky to squish nuance into 800 words at
yeah,
the times.
It is.
I think one thing she's absolutely right about is any attempt to disengage from the culture of vulgarity often carries professional consequences,
yes,
too. I know that I've seen that Weinstein shot down the very talented actress Sophie Okonedo because he said he didn't think she was effable, right? So
oof.
Not only did Weinstein victimize actresses he hoped to cast, he victimized actresses he pushed away from parts because he didn't want to prey on them and therefore saw no reason to have them in his orbit at all. And I'd certainly find it plausible that Bialik has had experiences like that of being pushed away from opportunities because she isn't rising to the attention of predatory men. I think what every woman knows is that there's never anything you can wear that will stop someone whose intent is to prey on women from doing it, especially when some predators are more interested in power than sex and want to make people feel uncomfortable. And at that point, the depth of your neckline doesn't matter to them because what they're looking for is the fear in your face. I've had this experience too where I was being really hassled by a cabbie in DC, and I stopped taking cabs in DC because it happened too often that a cab driver would make me feel unsafe. And I know this is radio, but I'm a very boring dresser. And I was in the cab thinking, you know, this isn't fair. Like, I'm wearing my unflattering khakis. And I just think that for a number of people who go after women, it has nothing to do with what they're wearing or how they're behaving. It has to do with his own feelings and his desire to make someone uncomfortable. I mean, I think that part of the desire there is there something women can do to make themselves safe? And there are things you can do to make yourself safer, but there really isn't anything that women alone can do that will make them safe from sexual assault or harassment.
At the end of September, a woman named Anila Dolatzai boarded a Southwest Airlines flight in Baltimore, bound for the West Coast, to visit her ailing father. There were two dogs in the cabin, one a pet and one an emotional support animal. Dolatzai informed flight attendants that she is allergic to dogs. From there, things get murky. According to Dolatzai, she had said that her allergy was not life-threatening and that if she could just sit far enough away from the dogs, everything would be fine. According to Southwest, she had said that her allergy was life-threatening, in which case she would have to have a doctor's certificate clearing her for the flight in order to stay on. Whoever's right, Dolatzai was asked to deplane, and she refused. Police officers boarded and dragged her off, and the inevitable dude with an iPhone got it on video, which went viral. Dolatzai is charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest and has lawyered up. Southwest has apologized for the rough treatment she received, though not for the policy that occasioned it. Why the dogs couldn't simply have been stowed in the cargo hold, where they really belong, remains unclear. I'm joined by editor Rusty Reno, proud owner of Lucy the Miniature Dachshund, and by senior editor Matthew Schmitz, author of a pungent recent column about pets. Rusty and Matthew, I've never been allergic to dogs myself, but I think I'm getting there.
Was it, have you added that to your gluten allergy?
Yeah.
There's something very 2017 about this battle between the emotional support animal. I think at least one of the animals on the plane was an emotional support animal.
Correct.
And a woman who claims a dog allergy. If you look in a place like Russia where they're legislating against gay pride parades, they're doing so on the basis that they offend religious feelings, right? So there, you just have this war of therapeutic categories. You know, oh, I absolutely can't fly without my dog because I'm so emotionally vulnerable, and oh, you know, I'm allergic to dogs. They must not be on the plane. So we just have the kind of war of disabilities, and you've got to fight fire with fire. You know, I think in that sense, I too must have a dog allergy.
Yeah, the other thing No,
you fight fire with fire, so you're in favor of the policeman who dragged the woman off the plane, the most anti-therapeutic moment in the whole scenario.
No, I'm in favor of kicking the dogs off the plane and their owners, if their owners really can't be separated from them. What seems very 2017 to me about this incident is that in my researches, I find that there is actually no airline in the United States that will side with a human over a dog when the two cannot share the same space. I don't understand.
That's kind of interesting.
There's no rationale. I think there's just a certain corporate interest in not tangling too much with people who say that they have a disability. So these people who have emotional support animals, they say, I'm disabled. I need always to be with my pet, or I won't be psychologically stable. The people who have a disability and are very sort of vocal about it and adept at manipulating these rhetorics of disability and vulnerability and rights. And I think obsessive pet owners tend to be really good at that.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that skill set is not unrelated to the fact that they tend to be bourgeois white people.
As it happens, an acquaintance of mine a year ago told me about his desire to have a dog. Now, he had an apartment in Chinatown here in New York where until recently, it was hard for people who weren't Chinese to get apartments. It was a kind of close community. People kept things in the family. And in the building he was living in, there was a strict no-dog policy. But if he got the dog registered as an emotional support animal,
they would have to accept it.
They would have to accept it. His Chinese landlord would have to let him get that dog. And he said to me, so should I have this emotional support animal? You know, it would be nice to have. It would support me emotionally, in a sense. I said, no, it's not a real thing. You can't claim you need it. But on the other hand, since it isn't real, since I can't imagine an instance in which a person actually does need it, maybe it is legitimate. But I looked askance at the idea. I don't really believe in this idea.
People should, if people need an emotional support animal, they should get a boa constrictor or something like that and wrap it around their neck. It'd be much more convenient.
Or one of those little suction fish or something, or a leech. Be with you forever.
There was a great piece.
Or a parasite.
I think about four or 5 years ago, The New Yorker published a hilariously funny article about, and the writer had gotten a whole series of different pets, including a snake, and went to all these different places, restaurants and everything, and always said, oh, well, you know, it's an emotional support animal, and my psychiatrist says I need it. And she said it was amazing how people acquiesced.
There's a guy who rides around Tompkins Square Park on a bike with about 7 chinchillas on his shoulders. maybe those are his emotional support.
So not a coat, but the actual animals?
Yeah, these little rodents.
Well, Father Thomas Joseph White was here in the office last week giving a talk on his new book, The Light of Christ, and he made, I think, a very strong statement that Catholicism is committed to the hierarchy of being, and so dogs are definitely wonderful animals, but they're below human beings in the hierarchy of being. And as a very proud dog owner, I can affirm that statement, that a dog is just a dog.
So there's evidence in the fossil record that dogs have been with humans for as long as Homo sapien has really been a distinctive species. And this is a fact much loved by dog owners. I think it is significant, but let's look at what the interaction was between humans and canines dating back to that time. So,
probably all for warning,
right? So
they eat scraps.
They had useful function. My own family, we always had a dog on the farm, and that dog was always named Shep. And Shep would die, and then we would get a new dog named Shep.
Shep one, Shep two, Shep
three. And he helped herd the cattle, and he had that useful function. And I think that the fact that we repeated the name helped indicate that. He had a function. He had a role. It was a kind of office, the office of Shep, of the dog. now obviously people don't have need for those animals, but it's natural that we still want them to be with us. I think it's actually not totally unlike the way that our relationship with children has changed, where there was once an economic imperative to have children so that you could do farm work, and now there really isn't that imperative, and so we have a stranger, more sentimental relationship both with our children and with our animals, but it's the same process affecting both.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm guessing that Shep the farm dog wasn't or weren't allowed in the house.
No.
People now let their dogs in their beds. Ew.
He had a doghouse on the porch.
I think that from a time immemorial, dogs have provided companionship. Dogs are you know, famous for their loyalty. You know, dogs are unlike people. They're unequivocally loyal.
And unlike cats.
Cats have a different allure. They're sort of magisterial and aloof. But yeah, dogs are great companions. It makes sense for them to be a favorite pet. Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with that.
I don't see anything wrong with it either.
Nothing wrong with your favorite pet curling up on the couch.
Well,
if he doesn't bother you, I don't like my
farmhouses. You'd even have the cow in the farmhouse in winter, for example. So
well, yeah, but that's for a particular reason, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can't, you don't have any other way of heating.
It's just hard. You know, we're going through these industrial changes, technological changes, and yeah, leads to schizophrenia in how we treat these animals and treat each other.
Speaking of pets throughout history, Matthew, your back page column in the November issue of First Things discusses, among other things, the cult of St. Guinefort. So could you tell us briefly about the cult of St. Guinefort and its relevance to pet ownership today?
So Stephen of Bourbon, one of the very first inquisitors, recorded this cult in a French village. Peasant women venerated a greyhound that they called St. Guinefort, who, according to their legend, had defended a child from a snake that was trying to attack it. The child had been left unattended by its parents. The snake came into the room. The dog killed it, and in the course of doing that, upset the cradle. The parents of the child came back and saw the blood and saw the cradle upset and thought the dog had attacked the child, so then they took out their rage on the dog and killed it.
Prior to that incident with the snake, the dog had been very much a favorite of the parents, so that it even competed with the child for their affections, right?
So there's a very old tale called The Brahmin and the Mongoose. It's the most common tale in folklore, really across the whole world. It's the classic story of a pet that competes for the mother's affection with the child. These tales are about our kind of weird ambivalence toward animals, which we obviously want to embrace as children, but also hold off and treat as tools.
So the actual practice of the cult of St. Guinefort in France was effectively infanticidal, as you explained.
So Stephen of Bourbon, when he encountered this cult, suppressed it because these peasant women were taking their children to this cult site off in the woods, leaving them there unattended. And if the child died, they viewed it as Guinefort relieving them as a burdensome child, which really wasn't their own. But if the child lived, then he had restored the child to health, restored their child to them. So this cult was discovered in medieval times, but it actually lasted up, you know, in some form, it continued into the 20th century. And Guinefort's gaining new popularity, various books, films. Lady and the Tramp is a retelling of the story of Guinefort. And so you get these very sentimental, soft-focus accounts of Guinefort's life, even in Catholic publications, I found. You know, isn't it charming and fascinating that at one point a dog was venerated as a saint? And isn't it a little bit harsh that our churchly authorities won't let us enroll him in the Roman canon? But if you look at the history and see the way that worship of him actually, you know, I think it became worship. It wasn't a due veneration. Worship of him became infanticidal. It becomes easy to understand why the church suppressed the cult.
As you write in your column, it's not a coincidence that veneration of a pet coincided with contempt for human life, especially children, that are perceived as burdensome. And the emblem of that for us today, I see this around New York, is the way in which dog parks are taking the place of playgrounds, especially in neighborhoods that are gentrifying. And this plays into racial politics in a lot of our cities.
Yeah, I don't know about this. I think that, you know, the dog park, my experience in New York is it is the case that dogs are substitutes for children in many instances. But I don't see, at least the people I know who suffer from this, I think it is a kind of disordered relation to your pet, to elevate your pet to the status of surrogate child. They put little booties on the feet of dogs.
They put them in strollers, Rusty.
No, that's very true. They do. That's actually right. They put dogs in strollers. It's really kind of insane. But in my experience with the people I know who suffer from this this disordered love of their dog, it's not that they don't like children. In fact, they in many cases wish they could have them.
I agree. Think they want children on their terms. Well, I think that is the critical
so
thing.
I think maybe, I think that, that that's
which is the same as not wanting
I think
children.
That there's a cult of loving dogs. There's a cult of pet ownership, and what that cult does, what the cult of Guinevere insidiously does, is it invites us to describe what is not a good, just, and healthy society as one that is absolutely fine. So if we currently have an economic and social order where people can't get married when they want to, where they can't have as many children as they want to, and if you see expressed desire in America, people want more children than they're having. It's not that people don't want to have children, it's that they can't for, you know, why is that? Well, you could look at Mark Regnierus's article for us, The Death of Eros. You know, the dating market is difficult. There are obviously economic reasons. You know, there aren't kind of clear career paths. And then there's a culture that describes these facts as positive things. And that's a lie. And so I just wanted to punch at that.
Denigrate poor Lucy.
Yeah, not so much to denigrate dogs and dog owners, though, you know, if there's a little collateral damage rhetorically, it's all right.
Lucy's a big miniature dachshund. She can take it.
Yeah, no, dogs will come back. You know, they'll love you all the same. But
well, you know, when you have children, there's a lot of speculation now that pets, dogs and cats, help your children prevent developing allergies. And so
they're probiotic. That's what I read.
Is that what they call it?
Probiotic.
And so if you don't want your children to have like peanut allergies and things like that, get a dog.
Or just feed them peanut butter.
Get a dog and let the dog sleep in the crib with.
Oh,
with
don't the let baby. The dog sleep in the crib.
We had Basset Hounds when I was a small child, and they're pretty ridiculous dogs. And so the fact that I have a miniature dachshund now is probably due to this imprinting as a small child with having a ridiculous dog. After that, it was mostly mutts who ran around the neighborhood. Yeah, that's another thing too. I found when I moved to Omaha, Nebraska, we had two dogs at the time in 1990, that when we lived in a working class neighborhood, you could open the door and the dogs would run around the neighborhood. Then we moved to a nicer house in a nicer neighborhood, and the neighbors freak out if you let your dog run around the neighborhood.
Right. This is, you mentioned gentrification earlier, and this is one thing that happens in these gentrifying neighborhoods, that you know, people are charged with animal neglect.
We are for
just doing the thing they've always done.
Exactly.
With their dogs.
No, we are constantly being accosted. My wife and I are constantly being accosted in the streets of New York by strangers who tell us that what we're doing with our dog is bad.
What are you doing with your dog?
Well, she walks
walking
without
her
a leash.
Without booties?
Well, she walks without a leash.
That's bad.
So she walks along next to us without a leash, and we've been told by many people that the dog could run into the road and be killed, which is actually true. But it doesn't disturb me. She's a very reasonably obedient dog. We don't put a coat on her in the wintertime. I don't understand. What's with dog coats? They're born with coats. And then we get accosted by people who think that we're abusing our dog by having it walk in 40-degree temperatures without some special coat. Although we did buy a Nebraska football jersey coat for Lucy, so oof. On game days she does wear
Nebraska football is an even unhappier subject.
Yes,
than,
well, it's a bad year. It's a bad year.
Rusty, that's a form of abuse. You're humiliating that poor dog by making her represent one of the worst teams in the Big Ten.
I know. If we could get the conversation around the football, we'd get Julia on board with
who's
enthusiasm.
Who's won more games in over the program history, Penn State or Nebraska?
Rusty, you're a theologian. Try to take sentiment out of this question. In seriousness, do dogs go to heaven? We asked Francesca Murphy about this, and she gave us her answer.
No.
What is your answer?
No. What was Francesca's answer?
She said, well, we can hope.
Yeah, dare we hope.
And she said now, that there will be purgatorial fire for the dogs that
misbehaved
with cats,
yes,
in their lives.
Yes. Francesca's opposed to universal salvation of humans, but she's in favor of the salvation of dogs. That is very fitting. No, obviously, dogs don't have rational souls, as do humans. So we're at the top of the hierarchy of the created order, and that's part of the theological importance of the salvation of the second Adam reverses the sin of the first Adam, and that this has reverberations throughout the created order. So all created things participate in the salvation of the human race, but not in the form of beatitude, not in the form of beatific vision, seeing God face to face.
It's a difficult question. It was reported a few years back that Pope Francis had said that dogs would go to heaven. And then the Vatican had to put out an embarrassed clarification and say, well, no, he hadn't said that. But what he had affirmed was what Rusty just said, that creation will be redeemed, but not that dogs will go to heaven. So Francis has not quite pleased everyone on this score.
Okay, Rusty, very last question. Have you met Lucy's birth mother?
No, we got Lucy. That's so funny because Francesca told me this story about walking in Greenwich Village, and this very flamboyantly gay man came up to her and wanted to know what breed her dog Olivier's birth mother was. In proper politically correct deference to Francesca as Olivier's true mother. And Francesca thought that was just about the most ridiculous thing she had heard all week long.
Yeah, it's surrogacy.
We do talk about our dog as the grandchild substitute, but that is mostly to put pressure on our daughter.
I'm sure she's grateful for that.
I'm joined by Lucy, the miniature dachshund. Lucy, I wanted to circle back to the issue of what place, if any, dogs should have in the lives of humans. Sit. My idea that dogs don't belong in the house, I can relax that. But I think you'll agree that dogs really don't belong on planes. But heck, there are lots of human children I wish I could kick off of planes. Listen, I was radicalized against dogs after moving to New York. Every day, on my way to and from work, I walk past Gramercy Park. I'm sure you're familiar with it, because every dog in the city appears to use it as a latrine. And so what should be one of the most beautiful parks in the city, a place that people can enjoy, instead smells like a barnyard. I'm not specifically blaming you. One morning a week, I walk past a mobile pet spa parked outside one of those posh apartment buildings on Gramercy Park North. True fact. You know that joke attributed to Orwell, that if aliens ever came to Earth, one of their misconceptions would be that humans serve and worship dogs because we walk behind them and pick up their droppings? I'm sure that was very funny to Orwell because he didn't live in New York. I think that certain non-Western cultures, where dogs are not kept in the house, but instead are slaughtered as vermin or for meat, those are anthropologically superior cultures. Their cities accommodate more people than dogs. QED. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not against your species exactly. It's just I wish there were fewer of you. You're actually a very nice dog, as dogs go. You're very long. I'm sorry. Don't tell your grandpa. That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to Leah Labresco Sargent and to my colleagues, Rusty Reno and Matthew Schmitz. Thanks also to Lucy Reno. No miniature dachshunds were harmed during the making of this episode. And thank you, listeners.